All right, and we are live. It is about 9:40 a.m. here on Tuesday, October 18th, coming at you live from beautiful Belgrade, Serbia, center of the world, at least the center of my world. Here we are with a little episode on war and reset. I realized that in my materials, I'm producing content from a very, in a very, I would say, tight time schedule and a, you know, chaotic way. And I want to apologize for can't always or haven't always gotten the streams up to the drive or been able to process, folks having access to the drive, who've been generous have signed up to pitch in a couple cups of coffee every month. So I apologize that I haven't always gotten, but everything with a few technical snafus, and they were good episodes, unfortunately, didn't get recorded, but there's, I think, almost 120 episodes there. It's almost all of them. And it's really in between, number one, you know, I'm under a permanent investigation. And that's a problem. That's beyond surveillance or policing, you know. I'm being watched, and it's like not fun. But I mean, it's been a number of, about 4 years, it's been crazy. I think 5 years, it's been pretty crazy, something like this. And with a newborn in the picture and a toddler, and just, you know, having to always move your schedule around these things. And with the complications in the pregnancy, and then the little guy with his colic, and then the hernia, has been really a series of things. I don't know if folks know. I know it's just life. I'm not trying to dramatize things that are just called life. I know we all got, you know, relatives and stuff, and people been in and out of ICU and cancer and life. I know. But in my life, what's been chaotic has been, fortunately, blessings, but it's just been chaotic. And having to carve out the space and make it happen. On top of, I'm talking about doing this, on top of my regular research and reading that I have to do. I have a schedule, a lot of things to get through. Really, we're talking about 25 books at present that I'm either working through or reworking through that are from the primary source materials used in setting up the Great Reset. Now I would say this is the official list. So this is sort of like when you spend time with indexes from the World Economic Forum, like when you spend time with their indexes or their further reading lists and things like that, this is what you get, or the footnotes, end notes, things like that, okay? These are the works of like Rifkin, for example, or some others that we've talked about. And then there's the things that are the formative, the sort of things that are not said. There are, of course, the mandates that come out of, or the agreements that come out of these different pseudo supranational organizations that connect mostly these so-called international community countries. So like the NATO countries plus A5 plus Japan and Israel and maybe Taiwan and, you know, some couple others. But that's the international community, and that's sort of the conversation that takes place at the level of the World Economic Forum surrounds that. The golden million who rule over the golden billion. By the way, the golden billion is a really it's a fucked up and kind of wrongly conceived expression. I was not happy that that Putin used it, but it does. But he did say golden million. Also, he said golden billion or rather golden million, or he said golden million or rather golden billion. Golden million is more like it. The golden million, even though they directly have the authority to rule over the golden billion refers to the combined residence, I think, of the international community. Well, it's about 300 something million in the US, 500 million in Europe, another 200 million between some of the other countries of it. It's about roughly a billion people. And yeah, it definitely, from a kind of a Maoist labor aristocracy, or maybe international relations, it would be world, like three worlds theory is Mao, but that influenced greatly on Marxism in IR, which Marxism and IR basically, I think it mostly folded into realism. Interestingly, because it's not liberal IR, it's not idealist IR, it's objective, kind of objective analysis in a sense. And that is, you have this, the idea that, you know, you have the golden billion, and that as if these governments were interested in protecting resources and protecting or ensuring lifestyle and quality of life for the billion people who live in the countries of the, you know, Western world slash international community that rule them. And that's just not the case, right? That is maybe the case that students at Berkeley who are Maoists think from, you know, the fucking RCP or the Maoist International Movement or something like that. I call it Mimkonomics. That's what I call it. From Mim, Maoist International Movement. I call it Mimkonomics, the idea that the first world proletariat is a labor aristocracy in the sense of that they participate in the co-plundering or co-expropriation of super exploitation of third world labor. I actually showed in 2005 how this was actually a case of a mental retardation more than anything else. It didn't take into account things like purchasing power parity and value added, and tried to reduce just stupid mathematics. I won't bore you with the details, but it actually predominates, and it's actually part of a problem that reinforces the migration crisis and reinforces all the soft power shit. And the left is basically doing gargoyle effect by promoting this, you know, golden billion stuff. So even though it's true that the most rapacious oligarchs of the so-called West have super exploited whenever possible, the so-called developing world, so-called third world, whatever, they didn't do so to fucking then be like, oh, here, Joe the plumber, here, have some extra money. No. They rolled out debt. They rolled out the opposite of that. So, that's not at all what happened. Basically, what you have is the Maoists and the, you know, post Paul Craig Roberts, Reagan administration agree on trickle-down economics. If that had been the case, of course, the world would be very different. But, you know, it's a big problem in trying to communicate with people who don't understand And it can confuse people in the United States too, when they actually see for themselves the levels of poverty in the U.S. I don't think it's as great as the poverty in England, but it's by the numbers, just because of population difference, the poverty in the U.S. is huge. And these aren't people that fell between the cracks. This is the structure of the thing. It's the structure of the thing. It's supposed to be like that. I mean, in the way that they, quote unquote, you know, them. And I don't, by the way, that's, people ask, well, what are you saying, that they, them? And as if that's some new thing. That's not an anti-Semitic thing. That's the them is like, what you've been saying all your life, like, hey, they're saying the schools are going to be closed on Tuesday, or hey, say they say it's going to be raining. Oh, they say inflation's going up. Oh, they say it's basically they is the kind of the voice of the system, the conventional wisdom, the things like this, this kind of interface that we have with the world. You talk to people and you're like saying, well, it's not my opinion, is what you're saying. You're saying, like, you know, they say. It's a profound thing, because in our overly polite interactions with people at times, and we're not overly polite. I put it that in scare quotes. It's just a stupid way of being passive aggressive or cowardly. We always speak with people in the tone from the voice of they and them. Unless we want to insert, like, well, I'm not sure, I really think so. But we're always trying to signal that we get it. In other words, like, are you dressed differently because you don't know what the fuck other people are wearing? Or are you dressed differently because you know what other people are wearing and you want to dress differently? You see, there's a big difference there between unawareness and hyper-awareness. War is a part of the Great Reset, and the balance of powers and the way development works, economic development, is sort of like this. This is what we're going to talk about today. And we've mentioned it before, but as I said at the start, forgive me that all my titles and stuff aren't, and they'll never really be, because in an hour, two, or three, that we talk about a lot of different subjects. And what I've decided to do is to reduce the latitude or the breadth of the subjects, if avoidable, so that when I title these, it more accurately reflects the thing that we talked about, because people have a hard time finding when we talked about certain things, and I can't either. I also, when I go back to listen to, you know, myself, you know, after I think, boy, I need to get my nose decongested, I normally think things like, wow, who's this guy? Or I never heard this before. So I'm usually, even though the way the brain works is weird, and I call it, it's a live stream. And as you know, I do it very stream of consciousness. I do a live stream. Imagine I do a live stream, but it was scripted. So it's not, right? So I do a very stream of consciousness, like a live stream would seem to be. And as a result, the subjects can get a little staccato, even, and disjointed. And sometimes it sounds like I'm answering questions in real time when unless I'm saying I'm doing that, the reason it sounds like I'm doing that at times is because I'm laying out a thesis or connecting different things and showing how things connect, number one. And number two, I'm a divergent and horizontal thinker, which means that I find the patterns and parallels and things like this you know, pattern recognition from one thing to another. So even though you may think I'm changing subjects, I'm actually on the same subject of that pattern. So there's different ways to look at that. But there are people who actually listen to these episodes and kind of get into working out, you know, dividing it up, actually. A couple people have been remixed some parts and clips and recordings and stuff with good consequence, and I've been happy with that. Been like very honored and happy to find them in my inbox sometimes, and people remix stuff or catalog things. So shout out to you folks, Jonathan and Nikki and a few others. So even though some of the stuff we've mentioned before, we're going to focus on this aspect of the Great Reset and war. The main thing is this. War, in economic terms, sets back the hands of time because it destroys the means of production, which expand and accumulate through time. So when you destroy the means of production, like a factory or something like this, infrastructure, but productive infrastructure more than facilitating infrastructure, you actually set back the hands of time. And you would be asking, well, Joaquin, that's not very profitable. Why would they destroy or want to destroy their investments? Why would they want to set the hands of time backwards? I thought these people were futurists and they want to march us into greater technology and, you know, greater future, and we'll all be all fucking side transsexual cyborgs. Okay. Sure. Maybe. But if that is their goal, that's not how you would get there. Because the actual development of economies and technologies, applied technologies, that's like the economy, as opposed to latent or, you know, researched but not implemented, okay? Applied technologies in the economy, these actually are net, you know, long-term, net losers. All technological developments are ultimately zero sum game. They are disinflationary, meaning that the more that we introduce expanded productive capacities relative to population, prices will go down and down and down. Okay. Profit typically in this type of calculation as a fixed, well, it's always variable, but any given time fixed, a fixed in that particular circuit of capital, when you're tracking a particular a capital along a circuit, it remains fixed in the calculation. There's a way to, you know, use calculus to also include its changing rate through the circuit, which is a basically multiplying by a variable plus parentheses over the dividend. No, well, at any rate, forgive my my lapsus, my Joe Biden moment there. You get the idea. So in the most simple terms, though, even though a particular industry or a particular business or owner that invested in technology might get a certain boom, okay, or maybe high, just purchasing or investing in that new technology, like, makes money for people who invested it, okay, in that, you know, short term, midterm, but all applied technologies that are economic, meaning that they reduce the amount of human labor power required for doing some, you know, producing a good or service, that lowers the ultimate price because you've reduced the human labor cost. And when you actually calculate every cost into production, every cost is ultimately a human labor cost. So just because in your particular business, you have what you pay your employees, but then you have like the thing, like the goods and stuff that you buy, the raw materials, the whatever, and they put it together, okay, those raw materials, you buy them as materials, but in turn, those were procured involving human beings to get them, whether it was to pull them out of the ground, to clean them up, to hammer them to shape, to pull them off the assembly line, whatever it was, whatever your widgets are, human beings made them. So human beings are at the center of all economic life. Surprise, surprise. Here we are, human beings talking about things that we build and do. So it's a little troublesome, the deficient thinking out there. The contrary. Between most labor theory, subjective or real theories, value and fact. They're looking at the practically unrelated in the immediate sense. Price disclosure between two parties is not the same thing as this inflationary trend in technology over time. So in this actual conflict, okay, Russia is in a very difficult situation. They do not want to have a destroyed Europe. Okay, a destroyed Europe. At this time, of course, there's been moves and attempts to change the equation by cutting Russia completely off from Europe. And what European leaders either at some level seem to realize, and if they don't, necessarily must realize, is that allowing the Atlanticists to technically cut Europe from Russia means that for Russia to regain access to the European market, which it's better in terms of selling energy to a more advanced economy, even if that more advanced economy for its own investors and its own owners is debt-driven or unprofitable, or the organic composition of capital, like the rate of robots versus humans, and robots, I mean anything automated, okay? The ratio of when you look at a thing, back to your fucking widget, okay, how much of that widget being produced was from humans moving their, like burning calories versus machines? Obviously, it takes both. So you would call the part that humans do, the variable cost or variable capital, because they are variable. It can be lowered or raised. And then you have the, you know, infrastructural and automated, et cetera, aspect. And that's like your constant capital. Altogether, in the way I have it, there's some other guy who deals in similar things. I forget his name at the moment, but I actually think he gets quite a bit wrong. We had a conversation about organic composition of capital. He didn't get it all fucking wrong. Organic composition of capital is the ratio of constant and variable capital. So as that organic composition of capital meaning investments, technology, whatever, is more heavily and heavy, the more it's robot sided, unemployment goes up, but yet those unemployed or those underemployed shouldn't, in theory, experience the consequences on quality of life in terms of in terms of goods and services consumed, because the price of production goes down. So even as your salaries go down, the prices of production are going down. That's disinflationary. Now, $1 that you have, that $1 you make a week, well, now you're finding you go to the store and everything costs 5 cents, 10 cents. Like, oh, I could do this. I can make $1 a week. I can make $10 a month if everything costs 5 cents. That's disinflationary. That's like when you watch those fucking cowboy movies and they put 5 cents on the table and they're like, it's on me, folks. A silver dollar. Next round's on me. So you have like this whole thing with Ukraine. And the Atlanticists certainly would like to see Russia destroy Europe. You see, calling them Atlanticists, even though it comes out of their own, you know, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, even though it comes out of that, by the way, calling them Atlanticists is calling them the, you know, fallacious performers upon the concept of a permanent Atlantic Treaty Organization. But it's a very fitting term because the Atlantic Ocean is water. And it's not the U.S. The Atlantic is not the U.S. The Atlantic is not Europe. So when people talk about, oh, the EU and the U.S. combined are at war with Russia, it's like, no, dude. These are the Atlanticists. I guess in the new populism, we can call them the cabal or the deep state. Although more technically, even in that parlance, it would be the cabal faction of the deep state, if you're really clear. Everybody, again, everybody in leadership against the cabal also comes out of a deep state. So it's not like a, it's not like that. It's a bunch of shades of gray hat fighting each other. But the Atlanticists certainly understand that what they need to do in this present time, if possible, is to set back or stall real economic development, to set back the hands of time. Okay, now that doesn't mean that research labs into voice recognition and human synthetic cloning get shut down. That just means that the actual access to goods and services at reasonable prices go down. And it, when you destroy the means of production, like factories and stuff like this, okay, when people go back to work to build those things, okay, both the prices are higher for consumers, okay, but also the profit margins off of those humans, like the profit margins that the companies make by employing people as opposed to machines, actually go up. See, it's so counterintuitive to how they kind of tell this fake story that when you try to keep up with the mounting contradictions and nonsensical statements of misfact that come out of, for example, the Blue Book, where we showed that the only way, I think that was on page 55 of the Klaus Schwab Blue Book, well, Mao had his red book and Gaddafi had his green book. So we're going to call this the Blue Book. I think it is. I think people will call that. I'm coining it the Blue Book. People will start calling it the Blue Book. This is the Mein Kampf of the Great Reset. And on page 55 or something like this of the Blue Book, they propose a formula about how this collapsed economy that was supposed to be caused by the 2 years of lockdown that didn't happen while we were waiting for a vaccine that we didn't have to wait for in the end. When you read from this, you can see very clearly that they're saying that the collapsed economy will actually push forward automation, which is retarded if they're saying it what they say, because we know that collapsed economies come with higher unemployment, and therefore hiring people, the labor market favors hiring instead of those who are hired. Well, it always favors you if you get a job and you want one, don't get me wrong, but just in terms of the money, it's better for employers if salaries, if there's a lot of people who need work. And then interestingly, and that's not what compels research into automation or implementation of it, because that's a cost prohibitive thing to do if labor values are cheap. It's only when the economy is actually doing well, and at that point in a virtuous economic cycle, that you have the push on wages, you have wage increases, okay? That's, I wouldn't even call that inflation. That's keeping up with expanded productivity on a certain level. So in terms of GDP growth, actually it's been in the US, real wages have not kept up with GDP since about 1976. So all this complaining about workers wanting more money, well, they don't want more money. They actually are asking for less money than they had before, but they're just asking to have less of less money than before. But the aim of the reset is to, again, to destroy the economy. And so what happens, why if they're talking about the future and during the 60s we had cartoons like the Jetsons and we were going to be in flying cars, and now we have a new version of that where, well, we're locked down in 5-foot ceiling apartments, but flying drones come and deliver us food in our prison cell homes. I'm on the 600th floor in apartment 1605. I live with, my dinner ants and some maggots. I could use some salt. So to send the drone with some salt, that would be really good for my worms. They're a little old. And this dystopic vision that they're intentionally promoting is supposed to cause revulsion. Of course, they love how people who are asleep have no response to Schwab, but they know that people whose brains still function, that he market tests very poorly. He's revulsive, as is Bill Gates. So these are central casting characters. And they're telling you, like, be turned off by this. It's very interesting, the messaging. But in the actual economic long game, Now, the interaction of technology and physical economies, I understand. What I was talking about with U.S. monetary policy and kind of the weekly or monthly drama of it, not drama, but, you know, the inside baseball really is correct. I don't follow because I can't follow everything. It's not possible. So it's good that there are people out there that I talk to who do. Like Tom Luongo. So always remember that these moves come, and this is all in context of like Jesus Christ, they're doing like the all these strikes on power facilities and the nuclear drills are happening now or any day now. Wow, these are armed nuclear drills. That's kind of crazy. And this is what we were, what this is where we had left off on that, with that background is, Russia does not want to level Europe. Okay. The economic consequences of leveling Europe are not much worse, about the same as not having access to those markets. But if it's between having zero access and having access to a Europe that you've pulverized, and now you've had regime changes, and now, you know, Germany and France and are pro-Russian countries, all right, and now we build this Eurasian Union on the basis of a destroyed Europe, people who think, oh, just think of all the Russian contractors and the rebuilding and they're going to dominate Europe. That doesn't make them stronger. It's a greater liability and cost, political liability, perception, all these things are considerations in reality. It explains a lot of their approach to the war so far, very different from the shock and awe, you know, kill 300,000 women and children policy of the U.S. and countries like Iraq. As Madeleine Albright said, it was worth it. For the Russians, that's not worth it, and we're explaining why. It's beyond the feels. It's beyond things like the Battle of Hearts and Minds. It actually gets down to what's left of Europe. So much of the Russian economy was intertwined with Europe. It had been increasingly since the 60s and 70s. Some of the first pipelines opened, and that was with communist Russia. I was like, wow. That was after, you know, Hungary, and was that 56? So yeah, the West had a lot of reasons to be like, sanction Russia, sanction the Soviets. But that gas started flowing into Europe, you know, long before I was born. This isn't a thing that happened in the aftermath of communism. Yeah, of course, it expanded greatly, but just to understand the history of this and where we're at right now. It is, whatever Russia is, it is not a socially conservative country, whatever that means. Maybe some extremist hedonist things are considered more extremist or overtly hedonistic in Russia, but they do that there too, whatever it is, whatever your thing is. I'm sure it happens in, I know it happens in Russia, whatever your thing is, or used to be or shouldn't be, or someone else, you know, or whatever. I know it happens in Russia. And most people are like, yeah, whatever, to each his own. Like all this talk about it's a conservative country or Slavs are more communal or something like this or more. It's, I mean, yes, these are differences in like 2 or 3%. You know what I mean? Like, but it's a compound difference. So it's a geometric experience. It's a geometric change in experience in the whole culture, even though, you know, people are only a few percentage more this or more that, like more conservative or just on, and not on most issues. You see what I'm saying? It's just, it's very bizarre. They're not more conservative when it comes to things like pension. They don't want to get rid of Russian Medicare. They want to preserve it. They want to expand Russian Medicare. So is that more liberal? I don't know. Just, you see. Very, very interesting thing. But whatever Russia is, or whatever it is, it's certainly a much more evil country and a much bigger threat somehow than the fucking Soviet Union. So the thing is that you're saying, so Joaquin, why wouldn't Russia just pulverize Europe, you know, take it over, own it, right? And then what they get back, right, the rebuilding, because as you're saying, dude, that it's going to be more profitable at that level of development than the level of development that was destroyed, right? And that's true. Yes, that's true. Okay. But for the Russians, they have China over on this other side. Okay. And people shouldn't buy into any fucking narratives like axis of resistance or anything like that. Just by the way, you're not going to understand multipolarity if you're thinking in terms of axis of resistance. Axis of resistance was a period of time that involved a number of countries that were unified in counter-hegemonic stuff and were unified in going towards a multipolar world. But a multipolar world is not a world where all the different civilizations in the world are coordinating some singular plan together or building towards a new world order or anything like that. They just actually off in different directions as if they were different planets, different civilizations. There's always a degree to which civilizations influence each other and civilizations in that sense change. Not just for that reason, but for other reasons. But the kinds of things that you've seen in your lifetime have been imposed, you know, unilateral, overnight force changes top down, nothing organic about it, nothing that actually lines up with the, you know, in a kind of seamless or organic way with the native culture. It's like a little kimono with blue jeans or something. You can see how it works. But you can also see with the, you know, suicide rates and grass eaters what doesn't work. So the reality is that it creates a disbalance that favors China relative in terms of its relative power in the world relative to Europe. What countries and civilizations or countries or regions, what they want, speaking as countries, so that we talk about foreign policy, okay? What countries want is as many friends as possible. And you want to be in an alliance block that guarantees the status quo remain in effect. But what you're after is a preservation of the status quo. You're not after a preservation of the alliance block. Does that make sense? So alliance blocks are not out of affinity for some concept or an ideology or belief system or acts of resistance or something. These are practical, realist, and realistic policies. Now, ideologists and people whose job it is can promote and make it seem like something much deeper or profound than it really is. On the other hand, things can also be much more deeper and more profound than they appear to be or as they are presented. So it's not one thing or the other. These are my critical notices for you this morning on this. So Russia doesn't want to be forced into an alliance block with China if that's connected to an insufferable status quo. Likewise, when you think about Iran, this is a more microcosmic example, okay? Iran would like to be able to have balanced foreign policy with both Western European countries, maybe even the US, and Russia and China on the other hand. They want both, like Yugoslavia, like many countries that are powerful enough to become targets, so they're of the great powers. Because they themselves are regional powers, they're not, you know, a little Bahrain or something, or a little fucking Qatar, or some other insignificant place, militarily, or really economically, if not for, here, let's perform fellatio on your resources. In reality, Iran is a regional hegemon. It has a population and technical development commensurate with that expected with that population, such that Iran can conduct one defensive war against a great power while conducting a regional intervention at the same time concurrently. So that is in their doctrine, just incidentally. But just so you understand how this works, they resent in many ways that they're forced into a single alliance block with Russia. It's really bad for them, because in reality, the Russians are in the place to dictate terms to them. Remember, Persia and Iran have been at war in the past. Sorry, Persia and Russia have been at war in the past. Yeah, it's also true to say Persia and Iran have been at war in the past. I know many Iranians struggling with their identity. Many Iranians calling themselves Persian that weren't actually Persians. But,
excuse me, are you Persian? I have a new three-city, are you Persian, fuck.
I haven't been in, Ted Angeles in a long time, so I'm losing my, Farsi English, but it'll come back. I know I've got three cities down. That's a three series, BMW.
Bender, three cities. No, it's BMW, three cities.
That's it. I got it now. Coming back to me. I'll be jumping over that fire on New Year's any day now. So we got this problem with Iran is a great example of being forced into an alliance block, because in reality, what Iran wanted with the JCPOA and what its own oligarchs wanted, who are already partly invested in many global things. By the way, there's been a big, what's the word, kind of like coming back together of a lot of Iranians that were kind of pro-Shah and the diaspora are being brought back into regular economic life with Iran again as part of an basically expatriate community that now is in this great position to be involved in export import with things like maybe from Afghanistan, Iran, and things like this. So you've seen a lot of changes in the Persian diaspora, a little bit more. I mean, they have to be like against the mullahs, but they actually do deal with the government and everything all the time now. So a lot of things changed. And Iran was trying to be in a place where they had, where they're able to triangulate better. Okay, that's basically the long and short of it. And now they can't. Okay. Likewise, Russia does not want a weak, a disorganized, chaotic, or failed state Europe, as this take this as one flank away from them that they can bank off of and hedge their relationship with China. It's just such a mess for them. It's really a mess for anyone to be in a single party alliance or a single, like a permanent bloc alliance that gets defined as the status quo. Okay. And how can that be the status quo? It's actually the interests of each country in an alliance that have their own status quo to that they use the alliance to defend. But the alliance itself cannot be the status quo. And that's, of course, where you find all the shits and problems with NATO today. The existence of the alliance itself has become the value, has become the good, has become the goal. And that is a supranational or a non-sovereign goal, because it's to keep the, not the status quo of what works for you, but the status quo of what works for the most powerful interest in the bloc. Falling on a sword to defend the status quo is not in your personal interest, whereas the status quo for countries is supposed to be in their, you know, personal, so to speak, national interest. So the other consideration, however, or in with this, though, and this may work against this, it may work for it, is what we mentioned, is that if the U.S. really cuts Russia completely out of Europe, if the Atlanticists succeed in pushing Russia completely, and I mean entirely, because it's actually not, if you look, despite everything happening and despite the statements, it's the door has been announced that it will be shut and stuff like that, but the door hasn't closed. And I'm not optimistic that it will, or hoping of anything, okay? I'm just saying how I understand the lay of the land and what's going on. And Russia would be much better off with the relationship that it had with Europe, let's say in 2010 or 2012, as, you know, with that relationship, that the status quo that that relationship represented and the balance of power in the world, where China was in 2010, where Europe was in 2010, okay? Russia is in a better internal place economically in terms of their capacity to weather disruptions and import substitution, industrialization, and issues with supply line security, et cetera. And maybe this is a better position to have. But in many other ways, Russia was as content, or different aspects of Russian society were more content with the status quo a decade ago. Instability. Now, what we were saying was this, the thing that makes it difficult to think is that to work through is to what extent, in Russia's calculations, it becomes worth it to destroy Europe, to have access to it, Albeit that access would be to a much lower producing and consuming country, which means that they will sell less energy to Europe, right? I mean, how much energy, just think about it like this, how much energy, how much percent of Europe's energy needs was met by Russia, let's say when it was still, let's say 40%, right? Because it wasn't until recently. That was about average for 38% here, the natural gas, oil, this, and all of them together came out to about 40% on average for the EU power came from Russia. Or the most common figures that you saw for all these different countries and the different power that Russians supply was seemed to be about between 30, maybe 25% for one thing or the other, but altogether seemed about 30, 40% of this energy was coming from Russia across these different sources, LNG, oil, et cetera. So and natural gas, not the liquid, I guess. So they have the, you go back in time and just look at the volume of consumption of Europe, and that volume of consumption of Europe as it's growing, yeah, there's some relationship there in terms of population growth of Europe, okay? But I think what you'll find is actually it's the industries expanding, producing more goods, more services, that's consuming more energy, right? In other words, even Soviet scientists 70 years ago, and then reiterated like by pop science speakers, like the so-called theoretical physicists who still can't figure out the difference between an M theory and string theory, Dr. Michio Kaku, also talks about how one measures overall development in terms of energy consumed. I think that would be in joules. And he had like type O, type 1, type 2 civilization as a planetary civilization is the Kaku's frame of reference. And in other words, if your civilization is used maximum of all of the potential energy that can be converted into whatever from the planet, right? I mean, I guess you wouldn't have a planet if you converted all the energy into outcome. Although, how would that work? Would you still end up with the same amount of mass? Would you experience, I always wonder, like, is the Earth growing because of, like, sediment level and stuff? Like, why is archaeology always down unless the Earth is not growing, right? Anyway, so the amount of mass of the planet, right, and energy potential, when you go over, when you surpass the maximum energy potential of the planet, I guess you wouldn't use all of it, but the potential, and now you're drawing from the sun, and then when all of your energies, you're converting all of your energy into matter coming based on the energy from the sun, then you go from a type zero to a type one civilization. Okay. I'm not saying that I think that this framework is useful. Okay, this is the Kardashev scale and what we're talking about. And it's a method of basically determining like what the civilization's level of their technological development is based upon the amount of energy that they're using. Okay. And that was the Soviet astronomer Nikolai Kardashev in the 60s. And later, Michio Kaku, in talking about, because he's always promoting technocracy and the wonders of the future, basically, like he's the new, you know, Disney Nazi kind of stuff. In other words, like, hey, you know, all these issues of poverty and this and that are irrelevant because the rise of technology lifts all electronic boats and quality of life. Like Michio Kaku was talking about, oh, it's going to be soon the internet of things is going to be able to, basically you're going to be talking with people online, and then you're going to be able to materialize in each other's houses to have sex. I'm like, yeah, that already happens. It's called talking online and then showing up at someone's house to have sex. I don't know how you need to, you know, beam me up fucking Scotty to make that happen. I mean, I think what he's trying to do is do the basic, this is a script, you know, to make technology sexy. This is why people, I guess, buy Apple products. It's supposed to be some kind of status connected to the, I know people say security, but that's just actually relative to how few people used to use Apples. Now that they're very widely used, you get the same amount of viruses and stuff. You just pay a lot more for the same processor speed and features in the end, I think. But what's, you know, not for me to say. I'm only saying what the conspicuous consumption, talking about Velvin's conspicuous consumption, ended up in this. And even though those kind of things go towards consideration of, you know, value, those are called notional values or conspicuous consumption-based values. Notional value is very important in Veblen's conspicuous consumption and driving consumerism. But with all that, you're going to have more expensive things coming from Europe, okay? And they're going to be they're going to be using less power. So just understand what this means for Russia. Talking about like a economically destroyed, you know, fucking Children of Men scenario, which was not a Russian novel that was turned into, was not a Russian dystopic fantasy that was turned into a movie. These are Western dystopic, as you might call it, predictive programming. And the Children of Men scenario for Europe is a Western fantasy. And it's a Western fantasy precisely for the reasons that we're explaining. It's an Atlanticist fantasy. So I'm from California. When I look west, I'm looking at Japan. So my west, my looking west is east. It's very interesting when you think about that. I would always look at the sunset and knew that it was someone else's sunrise. So the destruction of Europe would make Europe consume less Russian. We're talking about Russian access, talking about the cost and consequence of access and things like that in that event. When you actually think about it, when you actually do your little maths, you're going to see that the costs of production are higher because they're more labor intensive, but boom. And because of that, the price that they can sell to Russia will be higher, which means that Russia cannot benefit from imports from Europe that are affordable, which 10 years ago, and in this kind of more stable status quo in the pre-sanctions environment and all of these things, this was amenable. Acceptable, even profitable. These are the things to think about. Now, what's strange with the Russian approach then has been people not understanding the kind of kid gloves approach, and our concepts of war, occupation, power, territory and boundaries have changed completely from the modern period, where all the references and meanings were not just symbolic representations, but the symbol representation also corresponded very highly, like a one-to-one ratio, with fucking reality. But we live in a postmodern world, and one of the and many things happen in changes and things, and you get kind of bubbling up the effervescence, and you get some fizz of good ideas that pop into bubbles and stuff, or good notions and whatever. Okay, many things and chaotic and whatever can produce that as well. Innovations, insights, okay, born by adversity. And one of the insights gained born through adversity, okay, in understanding how power works, is that power is not stable. Power exists in many ways by agreements in our mind. Power changes hands relatively quickly, and inflection points and disruptions that force temporary, you know, rewiring and rerouting of the, let's say, the network of civilization, of global civilization and supply lines, etc., that those temporary reroutings actually more tend to become permanent reroutings because of the cost factors and relationships involved. But the cost factors in rerouting, it would take, you've already rerouted once, okay, so you're eating that cost, and now when the old network becomes available again, you're going to go back to that at what cost, and then how long is it going to take there to make back what you know your losses. It's you can see how immediate crises and inflection points can permanently change the way business is done, and the resetists are banking on that. In fact, they write this explicitly in the Blue Book, The Mein Kampf of the Great Reset, written by Schwab and some sidekick with a French name. Probably the sidekick did all the work, but it's Schwab's book. Now I'm going to look. Question. Are we going to see a new attack on Kiev from Belarus in the upcoming weeks? I think that I think we very easily could. I think that that's the direction that things are going. I would be more surprised if it didn't happen. Nobody wants those things, but I'd be more surprised if it didn't happen. I'm going to answer a question about someone saying, don't disrespect Mao and Gaddafi. I know, compared to Schwab. I mean, actually, Gaddafi requires no justification or context. Is Dugan talking about Atlantis? So here's, Sweet, is that Sweef and Turf, or what is this? Swerf and Turf? Is that like a single white exclusive radical feminist and trans-exclusive radical feminist? Or I don't know what Swerf and Turf is, but here's the question from Swerf and Turf. Is Dugan talking about Atlantis just also in reference to some kind of more esoteric way as well? I'm not sure if it's Hyperborean or not. what, but I've been digging into these concepts since theosophy has a weird overlap with Fabian socialism, modernist art, feminism, and eugenics.
Yeah,
that's a good question. You know, I'm not a Duganist or a Dugan scholar, but I know that for sure everything is through some esoteric lens with Dugan. I mean, he's definitely doing esoteric metapolitics, esoteric geopolitics. And that's where it's at. Just so people understand at the highest functioning level. Okay. You know how there's that expression, millionaires are very good with numbers. Billionaires have a very good psychic. Yeah, that's pretty much the thing in terms of how the spooky shit works. You know, the higher up the hierarchy in our kind of modern secular society you go, the more actually you find among the ruling class, like these beliefs and stuff like that. It's kind of at odds with the secular modernity that we're sold because they believe so very much in like magic and sorcery and, you know, stuff like this. And I don't mean that in any other way than neutral. Just saying, you know, what I see, how I understand it, my experience, and some direct experience. They have, I know that Atlanticism for Dugan, that he's looking at things in terms of a logos of a, we're not supposed to say his name anyway, but for the philosopher who can't be named, rather, or I call him Big Sasha D. Big Sasha D in the house, he obviously has some kind of, there's some metaphysical thing going on with Atlanticism, but he would be looking at the logos of Europe and the logos of America to kind of get to the bottom of this stuff. And the thing with Big Sasha D is that the farther west that you're looking at things, okay, the farther west that you're looking at things from Big Sasha D's perspective, the less and less he understands them. But it's okay because you can, this is not a criticism of his ability. In fact, he understands, you know, things maybe more than the average person in Russia about the West in some ways. But he's never lived in the West and doesn't understand the way of the attitude towards life from a firsthand perspective. And it's just like when Westerners describe Russians and they use all these blanket terms and you're like, these just can't apply to whole people like this. And they do apply to whole people like this, but only by like 1 or 2%. I'm not saying 1 or 2% of people. I'm saying everyone is like 1 or 2% more this or less that. But because everyone is like 1 or 2% more this or less that, maybe the experience of it or what you see from the outside is more like a compound effect or geometric effect, as that differences in individuals are very little, the consequences and the difference can be much greater once you have the numbers of people that are all 1% more this or 2% less that. But I have like the American logos. It's something I work on. I'm exploring cowboys and Indians right now as my theme for the past like 5 or 6 years in my critical notes about in my thinking about an American logos. I have cowboys and Indians pretty much. Because I think that the logos of Russia is something like Vikings and Turanians or something like this, which is a lot like cowboys and Indians when you know what's going on. And that could, I think actually the US and Russia are very similar in that way, actually share a lot of similarities. Where you have kind of like a people from, you know, from Viking lands, then kind of spread out onto a big continent of land with where you encounter a lot of the semi-nomadic and horseback riding people. So you have this cowboys and Indians thing, like with Vikings and Turanians, like Russia. But I don't know where Big Sasha D is on that. But I know that, of course, this idea of Atlanticism for him would take on all of these, you know, metaphysical, supernatural dimensions. All right. Here's from TC. So one thing I'm getting, Russia does not want Europe destroyed, but Atlantis do. And war can clear the economic slate for them to write their new labor input. That's about it. Clear out losses. That's about it. That's about it. It's a good summary. Thanks. Thank you for that. I think that's good. Yes. I won't talk about that. That was our subject. We're keeping it narrow. So that's the thing. So these are ideas to play with. And when you work through and you think about, well, does maybe the U.S. not want to destroy Europe, or how does that work? And you can see where their position is, where you say, like, well, would maybe Russia be better off, you know, in the balance of things, to have access to a Europe that they've destroyed, to have access to it, you know what I'm saying, versus a Europe that's not destroyed, but then exists as a military threat to them, but at the same time as the type of yet, you know, threat today, ally tomorrow, when you understand that you're preserving a status quo through alliances, or not preserving alliances as the status quo. Let's see, what else can I say about that that it would be informative and necessary? So the U.S. sees the destruction of Europe. This is what we didn't tie in, okay? The U.S. sees the destruction of economies generally as advantageous to it, because it's invested in monopolizing new coercive technologies like wet wire, you know, neural implants, beyond, you know, face recognition, beyond social credit, beyond that kind of stuff, and or making health a subscription, so that you know, they've invented these kind of life terminating, you know, DNA sequence terminating nanobots that they're going to call viruses or whatever, and then they're going to then sell you the nanobots to fight the nanobots that they kind of the same with, you know, Bill Gates and the computer viruses, right? Or, you know, frankly, McAfee. But I think McAfee was trying to say that he wasn't writing the viruses, that he would then write the thing, but actually Bill Gates was, to sell the updates and to make sure that everyone had the licenses, because you can't get the, even if you have like a burned copy, the thinking and what they were trying to have it be was that if you have a burned copy that wasn't authenticated, then you can't download the security updates or the, you know, service package one, service package two, whatever, that type of stuff. So the idea to introduce that to humans, okay, not just to control them economically, but to control their activity, their thought, their actions in the world, and not just their labor activity, but their social activity, by saying, well, now you're not going to get this remedy. You're not going to get the cure. So now you're going to die. And to force conformity like that, because just in terms of our ability to produce things, okay, like goods and services, what we're seeing overall is a decentralization and flattening of those hierarchies. And flattened hierarchies are not appropriate for people attempting to hold on to central power. So this fits into our general thesis. And I know that it's in a fucked up way. It's my job to find the confirming, you know, information. I believe in my thesis. I think it's well researched and well considered about how this whole game is working out. And if it's not that exactly, it's something like that. I mean, you can basically, you get the idea of what's going on. Even if my version of it isn't exactly right. But certainly the concepts that I'm talking about do fit in, as I say, they fit in. I may not have a balance or the values to those factors, like in my mind, the right way, but I have accurately, you know, presented the different factors at play. And it's definitely a race to increase the coercive powers of technology while not allowing the applied technology of expanded economic growth, of expanded the productive forces to expand, to not allow that, okay? To set that back in time. It's not just about establishing control over those industries, okay? Because they could do that and still grow those industries. It's establishing control and monopolies over those industries, not to see them succeed. It's so bizarre, right? It's postmodern, but to make sure that they fail, but that they fail in a certain way, timed with other collapses and failures, so that we go back in time, right? Back in time to where, just for Europe and stuff, and parts of the US, you can, number one, make some more money on the side that can better your position moving forward as they go to post money. But the things that you can buy with money now might help you in the post money, not really post money, but you get what I'm saying. In the post-industrial society, you can't get rid of money. Money is a extension of human faculty. Well, you can get rid of human faculty. You can get rid of human faculty, but they, but provided that people have a mind, money is a natural thing for that, you know, because you, we all operate that way. Somebody does something for you and you keep in mind that you're going to do something for them. You know, you just keep it in mind. If you have an opportunity, they need a favor, they need something from you. You kind of keep, even though we don't admit that relationships are quid pro quo, they often are in some way. I mean, maybe we get something out of it beyond whatever. It's not necessarily your own personal interest in that moment in some Ferengian way. But, you know, even if we feel better for helping other people, we feel better for helping other people. You see what I'm saying? But money is just an extension of that. Money is just remembering, you know, is a universal medium of exchange. It's just the way that you would, you know, would keep an account and stuff of like of who your friends are. And you can do things for each other. You see. And that's the currency between you. And the money form of that is just the crystallized or solid form of the solid form of that abstract represented is reified. But they won't be able to control money if they can't. This whole thing about digital money and cashless is kind of a dream and a hope and a ruse and all these things, but it's also not possible so long as people are creative and can think, because you'll just start using fucking dates or coffee or sex or shiny objects or whatever else. You won't, if the money that they say to use doesn't work as money, if it doesn't have sufficient anonymity, if it's not usable, if it's not accessible, it's like that, then it's not money. People don't understand the value of money versus money you can use versus of money that you can't use. Money that you can use is infinitely more valuable than money that you can't use. And people will come up with forms of money that are much less perfect than paperbacks in some ways, but infinitely more usable than money that you can't use. And that's what I'm saying about human beings don't go away without a fight. Human beings, very difficult to conquer, very difficult to subjugate human beings. Very difficult. Yeah, good. I think this was a good, we got it out. We got it all out and we stayed on subject. All right. That's been on war and the reset. I know there's more in this and there'll be questions. And I know there's things that I didn't say that were important to say, but I don't want to diverge to land back on that right now. Let's keep it tight. All right. Peace. I'm out.